The animals roam throughout our cities,
manacling themselves to the shattered souls of those who would dive feet first into the vast pool of possibilities. They avoid classes of a certain sour stripe and the high-pitched hype of the media industrial complex, forced to simplify their moving stories for your entertainment needs.
Streets like the rest of them, but I can't forget.
Okay, so I am here with Lauren Bucus, who is most recently the author of Zoo City. Lauren, how are you doing?
I'm very, very, very jet-lagged. Thank you for asking.
Yes, well, I'm hungover as well, so I think it's an equal playing field. I wanted to first of all start with the issue of cultural references. This book has quite a number of recent ones. ICANN has Murder Weapon, which I don't think I've even seen ICANN has Cheeseburger in a novel, ever. Lady Gaga, well, that's comparatively recent, the 419 scams. I'm curious, when you deploy a relatively recent cultural reference, you're dealing with like a 2-year lag time in terms of the book coming out, what do you do to make sure that it's right, or that it's actually something that will possibly be tangible in a matter of years? Or do you have this virtue here, in this case, of a sort of sideways universe, as it were, so that as a result, whether a reference is dated or not, this is not so much a distinction or a problem?
I've never really worried about references dating the book. I think books are of their time, and I think they should be. When I was doing my master's in creative writing at the University of Cape Town, our lecturer said you absolutely should not put any contemporary references because it dates the book horribly.
Yeah.
You know what? The Great Gatsby is dated horribly. American Psycho is dated horribly. And
yeah,
they still work because the story is compelling enough. And it's actually a really interesting snapshot of the time.
Yeah.
So, you know what? I don't care. I like to think that it dates it. The book is set in 2011, and
yeah,
those are the cultural references.
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned American Psycho, because near the end there's a Phil Collins reference, so it leads me to wonder if that was a possible influence on getting that sort of juxtaposition of violence and cheeseball songs.
Yeah, I don't know if it was conscious, but it might have been definitely something that I internalized. Yeah.
A 2-stroke gash across the face of a menacing street urchin. The Maltese's car polished and waxed to an inch of its warranty. This is hyper-specific, very measurement unit-like description, which I like, by the way, reminiscent to some degree of William Gibson. However, at the same time, I know that you have also written for animation, and I'm curious if some of that animation writing background has affected your ability to describe things in this very ultra-precise manner. What of this?
I think there are two influences on my writing. The one is, and it's, you know, I've basically got 3 day jobs. I've been a journalist, I've been a TV script writer, I've been a novelist, and now I'm doing comics as well. And all of those different fields have very, very specific things to the discipline. In animation, you have to describe things very, very precisely.
Yeah.
The same with comics. You have to absolutely describe the scene. You have to describe the emotion that the character is going through. And which means I sometimes pull funny faces, you know, trying to figure out, oh, you know, what does a sneer actually look like? And how are they sneering?
Do you take photographs of yourself?
No, I don't. That would just be silly. But I should set up a webcam and kind of do a live streaming thing where people can log in and laugh at me.
So you need to know the precise expression of what's going down here. And then you have the option to describe it in detail or not, whether for animation or for prose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think journalism also has a lot to do with that. You know, the details of journalism. And I think details make a story. And I've been lucky to be able to do a lot of, you know, not news journalism, but narrative journalism and kind of investigative features and finding those telling details.
Yeah.
So I think my eye for detail probably comes from there. And then also the specifics of writing for animation and having to describe things very, very clearly and stage manage very clearly for the animators.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how much of this is an organic process and how much of it is considering the right level of detail that will communicate the information to the reader?
I think it's pretty organic. I don't think about it too much. Dialogue comes very easily to me. Action scenes, I really have to... They don't come naturally to me. I really have to work on them.
Oh, yeah. Why are action scenes tougher than dialogue?
I don't know. I think because I really like talking and I don't like fighting. I'm a talker, not a fighter. I think dialogue is so much part of who we are, and I really like using the subtext in dialogue, and of course that's very, very strong in animation.
Yeah.
I think it's also, I'm not a really big action movie fan, and action really has to do a lot to move me. I really enjoyed Hannah recently. I thought the way they did the action in there was just intense and amazing and surprising, and you really felt it. But so many action scenes, you know, the truck falls off the bridge and there are multiple explosions and it's just empty.
Yeah.
And so for me it's really trying to write meaningful action.
Is fighting similar to gestures, facial expressions for you? Do you have to, like, roll on the ground to sort of get a sense of how things are working out here? Do you have a sparring partner?
No, I wish. I did a little bit of kickboxing, but, that was years ago.
Yeah.
I do sometimes act certain stuff out, but not fight scenes.
Yeah.
But I will really think about the choreography, and I'll spend a lot of time kind of thinking about it.
The one thing about Zinzi's apartment building is how I'm very aware of the levels up, going up and down, walking up the fire escape, for example, with the power generator, or walking up all those stairs, the lifts constantly out. I'm curious if these, the idea of levels are a way for you to, I suppose, sidestep this issue of like, oh my God, I've got to write a action scene and I don't necessarily quite have the lay of the land, but I do have the lay of the land and I do have it from a sort of geographical standpoint. I'm wondering if you could talk about this.
In terms of the apartment block, I based it on real apartments that I visited in Hillbrow. I did a recce, a research trip with the fixer, and we spent several days walking around. And one of the buildings that we visited, the elevator was out. Somebody had left their taps open, and it had flooded the whole elevator. It was going to cost R1 million to fix.
So that came from real life. Wow.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of stuff which came from real life. It's practically Joburg verbatim, just with this kind of 5-degree twist to introduce magic. We walked to the top of the building and it was 27 floors and it was insane. It was very, very fun. You saw old people coming down, you saw moms coming up with their strollers and their shopping, and they had to walk 27 flights. It was crazy.
Did your journalist skills kick in? Did you talk to a lot of the people who lived at the top floors to get the sense of like how often they leave, or if they leave, or when they go shopping and things like that? Or?
I did talk to a lot of people. I was given the tour. Yeah, I got building management's permission to actually do the tour, which was really great. It's amazing how people open up to you when you say you're doing a novel. If I'd said I'd been a journalist, they would be like, no, you can't come in. But they were like, yeah, sure, and they assigned me the young security guard, and he took me up and down and introduced me to people. And he told me the story. There's a moment in Zoo City about... they talk about how building security actually busts a rapist, and
yes,
he did. He waited outside the front doors, the main entrance, with the woman who was raped until the guy came through and they bust him.
So it seems to me that you're going to get a more accurate idea of what Johannesburg is like if you are a novelist as opposed to a journalist. Is this one of the many motivating factors to stick it out as a novelist? Or?
No, you know what, I think is that I don't have time to do journalism anymore.
Yeah.
I love journalism, and I think journalism is an all-access pass to the city and the strange places in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been to some amazing places, and I've interviewed incredible people, and that's been a foundation for my writing. And I think that's given me more insight and been allowed me to write about more interesting things than I would have if I was a copywriter, and that was my day job.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that a lot of the stuff came from real life. What did you invent? I mean, obviously the animal situation, I'm pretty certain that's not going on, as far as I know.
Not as far as I know,
yeah.
Thankfully.
But in devising the magic, one thing that I'm impressed by is that it seems to be rooted in limitations. It avoids, I suppose, some of the cliches or the tropes of fantasy by, well, how Zinzi locates something is very based around the senses, as opposed to some skill that you can pick up in a magician's book or some spell book or whatnot. I'm curious about how you devise or you make shit up based off of pre-existing circumstances and whether this is really the best mode to work in for fantasy and fiction writing as a whole.
I think if you anchor, especially when you're writing about the fantastical, it really helps to anchor it on reality. It's interesting, I think maybe it was even Red, based on the Warren Ellis comic, and there was one moment where the characters just drive onto the tarmac at the airport, and it's a movie about superheroes.
Yeah.
So it's already unbelievable. But they drive onto the tarmac at the airport, and I'm like, you cannot do that. You know what airport security is like. And it just blows the whole credibility of the story. And I think you have to be very, very careful about what people know and what their experiences actually are.
Yeah.
I do twist stuff a lot, and I'll also throw out a lot of stuff which doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
And none of my characters are based on particular people, but I might take elements of people's life stories or little facets of their personality, and of course facets of my own personality, and kind of build a different person.
So the peer review process is really your own belief system, I suppose.
Yeah,
you have to
absolutely
believe in it in order for the reader to believe it.
Exactly. absolutely. And I think that's really important. But I also have a great group of writer friends who read my stuff and bust me. And you know, coming back to the geography of Johannesburg, it was really amazing. I made friends with a journalist in Johannesburg called Nechama Brody. And she wrote the Joburg book, which is a history of Johannesburg. And I would ask her stuff, and I would send her passages, and she would send it back and say, yeah, 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 but Jeppy Street's not on that side of town. You're going to have to, like, re-engineer it. And she would actually send me a Google map with the route planned.
Uh-huh.
So it is very specific and very anchored to the real geographies of Johannesburg.
So you paid attention to every single mode of walking and mode of traveling, including the dam. I know the Rand Club actually exists in Johannesburg, as does that coffee, the funky coffee shop,
yes,
and all that. Is there any aspect of Johannesburg here that was really just made up, or was it all rooted in real place?
Most of it is rooted in reality, but I twisted it to my own needs.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, I actually did go for a consultation with a Sangoma, or traditional healer, at the Mai Mai Market. But that's not how it played out at all, and the Sangoma certainly didn't use technology as part of it. It was a woman, but she certainly didn't use technology as part of that. And I also twisted the African traditional magic system slightly to suit me. The other thing, which is completely, partly made up, is that they were building the Gau train, which is the, it's kind of like an underground, but not quite. It's a new mass commuter transport system.
Yeah.
And I know that there are old tunnels under central Johannesburg from the original prospectors who were there back in the 1800s.
Yes.
And they dug lots of shallow tunnels. But to extend those shallow tunnels into the stormwater drains and then into the Gau train was completely fabricated.
Yes.
But it's all based on that scene.
Yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's also all based in reality, and it could be credible.
Yeah.
You know.
But that's interesting to me. You need to find an exit for that chapter by inventing something in this case. I'm curious if that was also the case to resolve other chapters, whether you... Well, I've run out of real material. This needs a way to resolve it. So, what can I invent? Is that sort of a strategy for you? Or?
I wasn't. It's not a specific strategy.
Yeah.
I mean, you do what serves the story. You. It's not like I'm like, okay, this absolutely has to be the real Johannesburg down to every street corner.
Yeah.
I will try and make it as realistic as possible, but I'm also going to take liberties where it serves the story.
Yes. So, for the magic, which we were talking about earlier, to what degree is a lot of that, along with what we haven't talked about, which is these alternating chapters with Zinzi's perspective, where we have like a sort of IMDb-like entry, a psychological abstract, things along those lines, which permit the reader to sort of realize, oh, well, there's a full-blown history here of something that has happened in this particular world, therefore we can believe in it. The question, I think, becomes, how much do you have to give the reader in order to believe? I mean, how do you figure out that balance? Because you can spell things out, or you can even offer stories atop stories atop stories, and perhaps there might be the possibility of overwhelming the reader. To what degree does the reader factor into this world building?
Again, I think it's, you know, it's a very, very delicate balance between being, you know, overly explicit and too implicit that people actually lose the thread of what's going on.
Yeah.
And I know that some people have enjoyed the book more on the second reading, because it's a noir, and
yeah,
you've got to concentrate. It's complicated, there are lots of different threads, they're major clues, but I hide them.
Yes.
You know, they're dropped into normal conversation, and if you're not paying attention, you might miss it and get to the end and be like, what the hell's going on? But if you go back, you'll actually see that I've threaded it through from the beginning. But in terms of the world building, you know, I hate the kind of world building where two characters sit in a bar and the one's like, so tell me, what's up? You know, what is happening here? You know, kind of the Morpheus in The Matrix, which worked very well in The Matrix. But there are a lot of pale imitations of that, and I didn't want to do that. I knew I needed to explain more about the world. I actually finished a first draft without any of those extra chapters.
Oh, interesting.
And I sent it to my editors, and they were like, look, you need to do some more explaining. You need to give us some more to work with just to kind of understand the world.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I just can't do the bar scene. I can't. It'll kill me. So I decided to do these kind of alternating additional materials. And it's inspired by people like Alan Moore, who've done that he's done that a lot in his graphic novels, where he'll have a burlesque song, which tells you a lot about the world, and that's kind of run through the storyline, or newspaper articles and all kinds of things. And it adds so much to the world, and it's also how we experience the world. You know, I'll be walking along here and I'll see, you know, a recruitment poster for the war, and that tells me immediately that there's a war on, without a character having to say, hey, there's a war on, I hope I don't get recruited. So I think, you know, it gives the reader a lot of credit. It allows them to take responsibility for some of the novel and kind of building it as well.
You say that you're good with dialogue.
I like dialogue.
Or that that dialogue comes easier than action. Is that a method for you to sort of find these details, the sort of needless line where it's like basically telling instead of showing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really like kind of just throwing in a line which is actually quite momentous. And there's a lot which happens. I think it's chapter 18 in the Sangoma chapter. And if you are lost reading the book, that's the chapter you need to go back and look at.
About the two-part structure of this, you end on the first part and it seems like the book is, well, it's pretty much over, or so we think. And part two has us realize that, oh, well, there are actually all these lingering threads that weren't resolved as characters show up, well, popping up almost like, you know, like zombies or whatever. I'm curious how much of this was laid down when you planned the book. Did you always plan for a sort of false resolution along these lines? Or?
Yeah, it's a red herring.
Yeah.
You know, the first solving of the mystery is,
yeah,
it's really just a red herring. It's not the resolution at all. And if you look at the original title of the book, you'll see that. I'm not going to say it now because it's a major spoiler. But yeah, no, I mean, I heard a great description the other day about how someone else writes, and I've just stolen it and I made it mine, which is that writing is like going on a road trip at night. You know where you're leaving from, and you know your destination, and you know some of the major waypoints along the way. But along the way, there's lots of space to take detours, and you can see 20 feet ahead of you in the headlights and the darkness, and you're kind of figuring things out along the way. But I always know my ending. I always know exactly where I'm going. I planned it very, very carefully. All the threads tie together.
Yeah. So you always had, I mean, I don't want to give it away, but I feel compelled to, simply because Zinzi does do the one alligator, two alligator vernacular, and then we have the literal alligator at the end. That was always very much in mind.
Absolutely.
Which alligator came first, the alligator through words or the alligator at the end?
The alligator at the end. The original, this is a spoiler, but skip this part if you want.
Yeah.
The original title was Pale Crocodile Waiting.
Yeah.
And it was always about this guy with a crocodile.
Yes.
As kind of the bad guy.
Were there situations where knowing the ending or knowing a later story detail infiltrated its way into the dialogue like this before, in other instances or anything like that?
There's an instance as well. The first time we meet Odie, he specifically looks at the pool, and there's kind of a level of resentment, and he throws his ice into the water, and I really try to build up the pool as quite a creepy thing. And later on, there's the interview with Song and Sabu and Odie in the music magazine, and they're paddling around in the pool.
Yeah.
And you won't get it at the time, but if you read it again, you'll realize, oh my God, you know, they're just paddling in that pool, and meanwhile this thing is down there.
Was there a specific real-life figure? I mean, Odie is interesting because he's a music producer in tremendous physical decline, almost comical physical decline. Your statement on the music industry based off of some producer you unrustled who you had to sort of put in your crosshairs? I mean, the fact that he's reclusive is one thing, but the fact that he's just this terrible mess is another, you know?
He's kind of an amalgam of several people that I know either personally or by reputation in the music industry and in the film industry.
Yeah.
So he's, I guess he's an archetype of kind of powerful people, but also himself. The decline, yeah, I think that is a comment on the music industry. And, you know, what I was very interested in when I was writing the book was specifically looking at the commercialization of young musicians, and especially young women.
Yeah.
You know, the Britney Spears effect, the Hannah Montana effect, and the commodifying of this great, beautiful virgin image, which, of course, is what Songhezwa is rebelling against.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted also to talk about establishing Zinzi's street cred. There are a number of little lines that lead us to believe that she knows the streets. For example, the pitch of the siren that draws this distinction between private security and the police, her incarceration in Sun City, teaching her how to stare someone down. These declarations are general enough for us to get the sense that, well, okay, perhaps Zinzi has lived. But on the other hand, if we think that she's somewhat of an unreliable narrator, maybe she's only fooling herself. I'm curious how you arrive at that balance of just enough ambiguity and just enough information to sort of suggest or connote that she has lived and had this past.
You know, I love ambivalent and unreliable narrators.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really fun to play with. But she has done her a hard time in Sun City. It's also, some of her history is based on a autobiography of a woman called Melinda Ferguson, who wrote an autobiography called Smacked. And she was a heroin junkie, and she was in Hillbrow, and, I mean, the opening chapter starts with her getting raped by some of the guys that she'd scored heroin with. And it was very, very harrowing, and I wanted to bring some of that kind of reality in. So Zinzi certainly has seen some tough stuff. And she's been in prison, and prison, particularly in South Africa, is very rough. I think prison anywhere is very rough. But, yeah.
Well, there's one suggestion, too, that her father is going through cinematography books, and there is a definitive relationship that Zinzi has with photography. In fact, there's the photographic incrimination later on. I don't want to necessarily give it away, but it is interesting also the fact that her name, Miss December, well, there's a centerfold name as well. So I'm curious how much this photography was placed in there and whether it was placed, it seems to be placed just under the surface. It's not an explicit part of the story, but it is one of these little bonus side quests, if you will, that will that allows one the possibility that, you know, well, if she's documenting her own life through words, why this concern with pictures? I'm curious how this came about and whether there was a draft of this where the photography motif was perhaps larger than it was in the final draft here.
I think it's just the things that I'm really interested in leaking through. I've had a lot of people comment on the style in Zoo City and kind of the fashion as well. And
yeah.
I'm always surprised when people say that. I'm like, oh, yeah, I suppose so. It's really the stuff that I'm interested in. I think you'll see the same in Moxieland, where one of the characters is a photographer. And of course, you know, one of the major references for Zoo City, and specifically the character of Slinger, who's the hip-hop star with the hyena, is the photographer Peter Hugo's Hyena Men photographs. And Peter's a friend of mine. And that was very much kind of what I was referencing there. So yeah, I think it's really just my kind of interest in photography leaking through.
I wanted to also talk about similes. This book is loaded with them, especially of the like variety. The first chapter just has tons of similes. And as we see throughout the book, there are many similes. You know, just to name one, Zinzi and Benoit curled together like a pair of quotation marks. At the beginning of part two, Zinzi remarks on trying to find the appropriate simile. How did this concern for similes come about? I mean, I had mentioned that this is sort of almost a sideways, a like universe, as opposed to something that is direct. Certainly we can look to Zinzi's past as a journalist, but it is an interesting stylistic decision on your part, so I'm curious about this, how this came.
I think it comes from noir, and yeah. I was reading a lot of noir. I was reading a lot of Raymond Chandler at the time. Yeah. And it's kind of a direct influence. It's part of the kind of the wisecracking persona and the comparisons, and it's very much who Zinzi is and how she sees the world.
Yeah.
She's always kind of trying to reinterpret it, also to suit herself. And you know, you can see that kind of, you can see her dark sense of humor in the way she uses similes.
Yeah.
And that kind of cynicism, but also how she's also fooling herself to a large extent.
Yeah. So similes were almost a way to lighten her really serious past and offer a kind of, I mean, if you're talking about Chandler-esque similes, which are always very sprightly and very loaded with life, is it safe to say that mystery novels were perhaps more of an influence on steering the direction of this forward than, say, speculative fiction or fantasy? Or
I think so, yeah. I mean, the New York Times described it as phantasmagoric noir, and
yeah.
I really love that description. I've called it Muti noir, Muti being kind of witchcraft or healing in South Africa, depending on which definition you're going for.
Did you consult any specific speculative fiction texts for similar language, lexical ideas, like as you did with Mystery of the Similes? Or?
No, you know, I really just wrote the story I wanted to write. And I also try to avoid reading stuff which is too similar to what I'm writing. When I was writing Moxieland, my first novel, I made the mistake of reading Oryx and Craig. And,
oh, damn.
And there were such similar themes, you know, I was looking at kind of the corporate state and consumerism and branding and... It put me off writing the book for 6 months. I actually had to walk away for 6 months.
Wow.
So I really try to avoid it, you know, because I just felt, oh my God, Margaret Atwood's done it, and she's done it way better than I could have ever done it. But
yeah.
Eventually I managed to get over it, and Moxieland became its own wholly separate thing, which I think worked out.
Is it possible for you to read fiction while you're writing fiction?
Yes, definitely.
It is? Okay.
But I do
it
a lot of...
has to be sufficiently different? Or?
Yeah. No, or yeah. As long as it's not kind of two similar things. But I do a lot of research reading at the time, and I try and really immerse myself in the world. So I was reading a lot of books about the DRC, you know, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and African magic and mythology and the music industry. So I really, most of my reading around the time that I'm reading a book is immersive research.
What about the italicized words? Words like lingo longola, you know, things like that, which I could find really no specific reference to, although I did find possible permutations of that. How did you devise much of this language? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of it is already there in front of you based off of talking with people. But how many of these words were invented or neologisms and that kind of thing?
All the words are real.
Yeah.
In Zoo City, in Moxieland, I made up some words.
Yeah.
But all those words are South African slang words. And what's interesting about South African slang, and especially in Johannesburg, There's a slang form called Tsotsital, which is basically criminal speak.
Yes.
And they use a mix of Afrikaans and Zulu and English and invented words, and it's all kind of, it's an amazing mashup of language. And it was very exciting to play with that, and I wanted it to be authentic Johannesburg and to throw in those words.
Do you feel that slang words reveal more than, say, description in some cases about, you know, racial identity or cultural identity or class identity, things like that, that this was one of the roles of this? Because I noticed that aside from, you know, a few thuggish characters, you tend to steer away from a lot of, like, transcribed speech for this. And so I'm curious if slang worked better for you in getting this kind of feel, this patois and all that.
I think it was just natural. You know, I was writing about the streets. It's the same as if you watch The Wire.
Yeah.
You know, it's not Shakespeare in English. It's the language of the streets.
Sure.
So it absolutely had to reflect who these characters were and where they were.
I was actually astonished to learn in the acknowledgments that some of the alternating chapters were not, in fact, written by you. I must say, well, wait a minute. Do these other writers, do they get compensation? Do they get some of the accolades here? I mean, come on, you're a novelist. You should be able to make everything up, right? Why did you rely on other people in this case? That's very, very unusual.
Well, first off, when the book goes into reprint again, I'm going to make sure that credit goes up front.
Okay.
It was a mistake just putting in the acknowledgments because not everybody reads the acknowledgments.
Yeah.
What happened was that I was writing the music producer. I started working on one of the chapters, which was the interview with Odie Huron, the music producer. And I wanted to do it in a music magazine style. And I approached a journalist friend of mine, Evan Milton, who's one of the major music journalists in South Africa. And I said, listen, can I check out some of your previous interviews? I need to kind of scrape some stuff together. And I'd like to bring in some real South African music history. And he was like, well, why don't you just let me write it? I'll interview your character. And I'm like, Evan, you know this guy's made up, right?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I know. Just, you know, let's work on it together and let's do it together. And it was such a fantastic idea. And Evan brought so much of his own style and also his deep, deep, deep knowledge about the South African music industry to this.
Yeah.
So then I approached three of the writers who had won the Moxieland Short Story Competition, which Angry Robot ran in 2009. And I asked them, I said, look, I'm doing these extra chapters. Would you guys like to guest write one? And they all said yes, and they were very, very excited to do it. And we discussed the ideas of how they would play with it. And they just came up with such fantastic, amazing stuff, which was so surprising. And it's really, you know what I love about like fan fiction or when people send me fan art is how other minds reinterpret your world and how they play with your characters. And what was tremendously exciting for me was that Charlie Human wrote a chapter about, it was a psychology paper about the undertow. And he actually undermines everything I've set up in the entire book. And it was wonderful because that's exactly what happens in the real world, is that we have theories on things. We don't actually, you know, none of us have any idea of what happens after death. Even in psychology, you've got Jung versus Freud versus, you know, all kinds of things. So it was really fun to kind of have that and to have this, something that I wouldn't have thought of. That I was so close to the book and so immersed in it that it was great to have somebody else put a fresh twist on it.
But on the other hand, I mean, if you have too many cooks in the kitchen,
definitely,
then that could pose a problem. I mean,
well, that's what happened with the third contributor, who's a really fantastic writer, and he wrote a chapter which was a very right-wing US radio talk show host. It was a transcription of that, but he threw in all these details which actually, you know, I don't mind a theory that contradicts my world, but he was talking about real facts, which contradicted stuff which I'd said earlier in the book about how the animals are treated in India, for example. And it just clashed too much. So eventually, you know, we discussed it, and I said, thanks very much. I'm not actually going to be able to use it. But I put it up on my website.
This sort of semi-writing by committee, I mean, it seems to me that this might have been one tool of the trade that you took perhaps from your television writing experience, that you think that this is more applicable to, say, fiction writing than we're willing to give credit for? Or?
I worked for 5 years as a TV script writer, and I was the head writer on an amazing team, including writers like Sam Wilson and Sarah Lotz. And what would happen is you would write a script, I would write a script, and then I would kick it over to Sam, and he would add some jokes, and he'd change some dialogue and make it, and bring in some action and make it smarter and funnier and cooler than it was. And if he changed something I didn't like, we would debate it, and then I would pull rank. But to change it back to what I wanted it to be. But for the most part, working with a team and working with other writers, the collaboration was astonishing. You just got such a fresh perspective, and 99% of the time, they would improve on your work and come in with new ideas and play with their own strengths. Sam's very, very good at action, for example, and Sarah's very dark, but also very cute.
Yeah.
So they would bring in those elements, and the end result was much stronger than it would have been on its own.
So you're essentially the head writer of your own novel then, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. But I mean, it's only the three chapters out of, I don't know what the total is.
Oh, I was actually going to go back to influence. I mean, I had mentioned American Psycho earlier. The sewer chase scenes remind me very much of The Third Man. And then the stuff with Baba Nedley, that's almost like Paul Bowles-like. This kind of, you sort of answered this before, but for specific scenes, do you often rely on visual references or even, you know, lexical references with which to sort of find your own way to get, say, the sewer scene or the alligator scene or whatnot? How much pre-existing text do you need to consult to sort of find your own sort of way to, I suppose, get the barometer calibrated just right for a scene?
I think practice. I certainly don't go and read other chase scenes to see how I should write a chase scene. I just try and make it as fast-paced and scary and dangerous as possible, which involves rewriting and rewriting. I think I internalize a lot of influences, and I read very widely and I watch a lot of movies, so I think you can definitely see that influence. Also, the scriptwriting influence, where I'm starting a scene as late as possible, keeping things really, really tight. And also, you know, there is almost kind of a filmic editing to some parts of the book where we really snap between scenes and there's not kind of a long kind of tie-in to, oh, how did she get here from there to here? She's there and, you know, you got to figure out that she got there somehow.
Do you worry that the influence of script writing prevents your book sometimes from being true fiction, or do you not worry about this mishmashing or blending of influences?
I don't worry about it. It is what it is, and I think it holds its own as a novel. As long as the story holds together, I think, you know, however that pacing works and however the story works.
Storytelling is the paramount concern, even more so than language?
Yes. No, I mean, Moxieland was originally written in a made-up language. It was very kind of Clockwork Orange style, and it took me about a year before I sold the book to just strip out all that language. Because it was a wonderful experiment in language, and people who read the entire thing in that version were very upset with me for daring to change it. But it ultimately got in the way of the story, and story is everything.
Interesting. All right. Well, Lauren, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
I used to be a simple living country boy. I was going to stay.